baseball practice is because I'm outdoors at a kid's baseball practice.
I mean, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. So, thanks you for taking the time out then in that case. So,
oh no, I'm happy to do it. I just, if you hear me, if I stop and yell at somebody whose name isn't Natalie Brittany, it's because it's my kids.
No, that's cool. So I guess we'll jump right in. The biggest element of what you having coming up is right now, you have this episode airing this week, Unfinished Business, which you directed in, which is not new for you. You acted in, which is not new for you, but it's your first combo of directing yourself in Supernatural on screen, which is something I believe only has been shared by you and Jensen Ackles, that element of you know, working as a director on an episode that you're highly featured in. So first of all, what was that, you know, how was that different? You know, is that sort of double the work of doing one or the other, or what was the process like to prep for that?
Well, that's an interesting mathematical equation you pose. I'm not sure it's how much it stacks up against each other, but I'll tell you, you know, if directing an episode of television is eating an elephant one bite at a time, which kind of is, it's consuming a giant, then directing an elephant in which you're also performing is like an elephant with a, you know, some kind of Shetland pony sitting on it. So, I mean, it becomes a bigger animal.
Yeah.
It's an enormous undertaking. And, you know, part of that is because it is just an enormous undertaking. Directing TV is a big deal. Mm. It's a big machine to move at a quick pace. And directing yourself makes it a bigger challenge and a bigger ship to steer. So that the challenge itself was enormous, but exciting enormous. You know, I think there's a certain feeling amongst my peers, Jaron Jensen, namely, who thought that it was just crazy making that I was going to take on directing myself in an episode of Supernatural when my character, you know, my character's the main guest star for the week. So
yeah, it's not like you're in the back burner. Like, I know a few of Jensen's episodes that he's directed has not really featured him as the main player. So yeah.
Correct. I mean, you know, in theory I could have directed one of the last couple where I had my mouth sewn shut. That would have lightened my load a lot. in terms of approach, you know, I kind of compartmentalized it because, you know, I now have my method as a director. Granted, I've only done 5 episodes of Supernatural. But still, even within that framework, I've started to develop a process that works for me. So I'm working that process. And the acting I've obviously been doing for 25 years. I have a process for that. So I kind of had to be sure both processes got serviced properly. And so the way I did that is really focused on the acting out of the gate. So I memorized my lines, got my character down. Granted, it's a character I played before, but there are new elements to the guy that are in play now, and just made sure that I got the lines down, understood what I wanted to do in the scene as a performer first, and then started breaking the whole episode down from the directing standpoint, which was doable because Bob and Andrew allowed me to get the script a little bit earlier than typically directors do. I got an early draft that wasn't locked in stone, but they wanted me to see what I was up against. So,
No, it's cool. Sorry, I just got the dog. It's all good. It's actually interesting to me for a couple of reasons this episode. First of all, did you, what you're talking about that you could have kind of, you know, you had your 2 episodes this season, 2 last season. They've grown in scope, the kind of episodes that you've been directing. Previous one did not feature you as an actor. Did you actually request to do one that you were both in, or was it sort of an incidental, like, did you request to take this on as an actor director, or did you, is that just how the sort of the dice rolled and they were like, this is what you have to do?
That's exactly what happened. The chips just how the chips fell. The assignment of your episode number comes early. I mean, July, you know, September, August, you kind of get to, you get the news, hey, you'll be directing, in my case, episode 7,
and
episode
20. Yeah, yeah.
So you go, okay, cool. And then as I was finishing 7 in post, Andrew and Bob came to me and said, look, we heard a pitch for a story for episode 20, and it involves your character. Do you think that's something you could do, or do you want to he wants to try to move you. I said, well, listen, I love the idea of directing myself. I said, now, if you guys feel more comfortable, like you want to have one of the veteran guys take over and swap me on in their episode, I'm certainly willing to have that conversation, but I don't want to give up my directing slot. So they said, no, we don't want to move your slot. We're not even sure we want to move you off the episode. We just want to get a sense of what you think and how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I feel like it'd be an awesome challenge. I say, we do it. And I didn't hear back from her for a while. And then I had a holiday dinner with Phil Segrecia right before the Christmas break. And he said, so we've talked it over and we've talked to a couple of the directors and we decided it's your baby. Now have at it. So it kind of was just a confluence of events that led to me being the guy. I mean, it really has to be a perfect storm. You're talking about a character that's been not on television for 7 years.
Yeah.
So that wasn't even in my mind that I would have a character to direct. And then they brought the character back because they broke a story that made sense and where it worked. And then you end up having the opportunity to...
The cat is even too small.
No, it's not. Sorry, now I'm talking baseball. Hold on one second.
It's okay.
It's not too small for you at all, bud. That's all I have. That's just tighten the back. You need to tighten the back a little bit. If you want to wear this one, you can't. Sorry, we're dealing with
it's
uniform.
It's fine.
San Diego Padres outfits being handy. Well, you got to wear a hat, so you got to pick one you're going to wear. You got to wear a hat. Sorry, my son, who's the whitest child alive, wants to bake in the sun. What was I saying? Oh, so, I mean, hey, how's I doing, bud?
Good.
To me, it's the luckiest thing of all time. It's the professional opportunity of a lifetime. Every interview that's interviewed me, I've used that phrase, so I'm going to burn that one out, but it truly is the professional opportunity of a lifetime. Who would knowingly give a fairly new TV director an episode of television direct in which he was a principal player? I mean, they wouldn't necessarily do that on purpose. And when you see the episode, you'll see how involved my character truly is, and it'll make even more sense. You'll go, "Holy cats, that's substantial."
Yeah, it's not. It's also not like you've directed yourself before in your own show in Kings of Con, which I'm sure is a bit of a different beast to a production of the level of Supernatural in terms of how they, you know, how they move their episodes along. Gabriel, you know, I think that you're saying that it's, you know, an unheard of thing. You've got a lot of clout in this world, though. Like, you know, you've, you know, been such an element of the show, you know, off screen and on, that it's there's definitely, you know, it seems like you're a pretty permanent fixture now. So, you know, is that something you hope to continue?
Oh, absolutely. I love that group of people, and I'm talking about the actors and the crew.
Yeah.
And the crew I'm talking about the post-production. I'm talking about the pre-production. I'm talking about the production. You know, I love the editors. I love the cameramen. I love the crew in every department, and I obviously am close friends with the majority of the actors.
Mm-hmm.
It's as close to a home set as I have.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely love being up there, feel incredibly comfortable and welcomed there, and have felt very blessed to have that as a place where I can cut my teeth as a television director. It's amazing. Cause those episodes aren't easy. You're talking about visual effects, special effects, or practical effects and stunts and deep rooted stories, heavy drama, comedy, characters that have long storied histories and relationships that must be serviced properly. It is a complex and fascinating show to direct. And I love that challenge. And then to be involved, I mean, you're right. I am sort of inexorably linked to the show. But if you think about the man hours that I've been involved in the show versus the number of hours that shows been on television, it ain't much. I mean, you know, 5 episodes of television, and now I've directed 5.
Yeah.
But 5 episodes of television that I was in before they decided to bring the character back to the season. That, out of 250, not a lot of TV hours comparatively.
But it's
a character I feel very close to. It's a show I know like the back of my hand, style wise and tone wise. And if I'm going to get a chance to play the character that I love in the show that I'm emotionally connected to, this was a wonderful opportunity. And like I said, it would never happen on purpose, but it happened. So I feel very fortunate that it was a happy accident that fell into my lap.
I want to talk about Gabriel, like, as a character, because you've had this experience with the show since the second season, and you're talking about an arc that's had a lot of changes for you in terms of you know, playing the character a certain way and then discovering actually a new secret about him, and that seems to continue even to this day. It seems like the episode we have coming up is a huge exploration of the truth of Gabriel's circumstances. You know, we saw, you know, his last episode when he pieced out that, you know, it's you know, probably a bit of covering up there about the truth of what was going on. And now we're about to delve into, you know, some of the deepest truths about Gabriel that have possibly been hidden since the second episode with the trickster, you know, that season two episode with the trickster, when you, to my belief, did not even know at the time, or, you know, maybe the show didn't know at the time what he was going to advance into. So basically, yeah, what are you most excited about to, you know, to be delving into this arc? Because you said five episodes in the past, and this season's already packing in more than that for you in terms of a deep dive into this character that's existed for so long.
I know. I feel incredibly fortunate to get this opportunity to have the story break the way it's breaking. Mm. Because, you know, at any given point, the boys decide they're done with the show. We never get to discover more about this character. Now, here we are, season 13, and they've turned the steering wheel back towards that storyline. And now we're getting to learn, myself as well, are getting to learn all about the character and the origin story, if you will.
Yeah.
And I love that, because really all these characters are complex. All these characters are nuanced.
Oh,
Gabriel certainly is. He comes in, you think he's a Norse god, you know, trickster god, and then reveals himself to be an archangel who's, you know, got family issues and, mm-hmm. and, you know, who happens to have a penchant for pornography. I mean, he's a very quirky, layered guy. Mm-hmm. And that you like, but you get frustrated with, you know what I mean? Who drops the ball mm-hmm. when you don't want him to, and then shows up out of the blue when you think he's done. He's a, you know, he's an enigma. And I like the fact they're finally going to unravel some of the why to his puzzle. Again, the fact that I got to be the guy helming the story was a huge gift, because as an actor, I read it and I know what I thought it should be. The good news is I didn't have to guess how it was going to play out, because I was also the one who's going to decide that.
Yeah.
So I got to be sure that visually, stylistically, and dramatically, the story played out the way I, the guy who played the character, felt like it should.
That's
a rare opportunity.
That is, I can't even imagine how huge that is.
That's the other thing. I directed, like, to your, everything you said about the importance of this episode, I got to direct. Even if I directed an episode with Gabriel in it, and Gabriel's a main player, it's unlikely that I would have gotten handed the origin story. But I got the origin story. I got the deep-rooted, this is what, you know, this is what has happened over the last block of time since we last saw this guy's story. So that's so awesome. That's so cool.
It's insane, to be honest. It's really good. It's for me, this is a very personally interesting episode, because my closest connection to this show, my closest friend within this community, is actually Meredith Glynn.
And
so,
oh wow!
So I'm very curious about this. You know, like so I'm very curious about what elements of her script that she, you know, prepared for this story of Gabriel that most stood out to you. I'm not sure. You know, not sure if, you know, we're releasing this the Thursday morning. I'm not sure what kind of teasers you can give, but elements of the story have really stood out?
You know what I think we should do, because I certainly, the last thing I want to do in this universe is the universe of Supernatural, not the universe that we live in.
Yeah.
Not the Stephen Hawking universe, the Supernatural universe.
Yeah.
I don't want to spoil anything except for any toes, but I will tell you that there's a great conversation to be had that, you know, maybe you and I have after the episode airs.
Yeah.
Because Meredith's script is fantastic.
Yeah.
And anything I wanted to see happen over the last 7 years, she and I had a long conversation, you know, sporadically throughout the shooting of it, but also just yesterday, we both watched the final playback of the episode to see it in its finished, sound mixed, color corrected form.
Yeah.
At Warner Brothers, and we talked afterwards. We're both tickled pink with how it played out, but she wrote a hell of a script. And I'm not just saying that as like a PR thing because talking about the show. I mean, it was fantastic. And I loved it the second she gave me the rough draft. I was like, holy crap, this is a dream come true for me as a director and for me as a guy playing the character. And for me to get to do both, this is ridiculous. This is great. It was really the perfect match because she really wanted to tell this story. And I really wanted this story to be told. And she told it in a much cooler way than I could have imagined. Because I've tried. I've tried imagining what the story would be, how, if this were to happen, how would it happen, blah, 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 blah. I've been asked that question at conventions. I've made up answers on the fly. I've thought about it my own time. Nothing I've conjured is as rooted, grounded, and interesting as what she crafted on the page. Mm. She did a great job. And at some point, you know, like I said, I kind of want you to... I want you to see it with fresh eyes too. Yeah, but like, you know, watch it with fresh eyes and then let's have a conversation about it after the fact. I mean, if for no other reason, just for the fun of breaking it down. Truly, because I mean, I can't wait for this thing to drop because I've been obsessed with it for 3-4 months. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's been ever since December, I got obsessed with the idea that I'd be doing this story, but I didn't know what the story was. Mm. And ever since I got the script. So I'm talking about, you know, March, February, I mean, whatever, whenever it was. What month are we in now? April. So like January. April.
Yeah.
Like January. So like January, I've been literally living this thing, you know, and it's, I'm really excited for it to get out there and for this chapter to be examined by the fandom.
Yeah, I am as well. My biggest thing, you know, with Meredith's episodes is that she tends to really go in, like she tends to go really deeply inside of a character's motivations. And obviously Gabriel is one character that, you know, has had that question mark for so long. And so that's something to really, you know, really shocking to shed light on. But how did you feel, you know, just we'll finish up in one moment. I'm actually coming to Rome in a couple of weeks to see you guys, by the way. So maybe we can talk then. But what was it like for you that so far the reaction to your reveal on the show? You know, like obviously you're with the Supernatural community every day, but like what was the reaction once people knew in the real, the big world of that we have the television show we actually watch, not everything that surrounds it, how has that felt to have that reaction?
It's been cool. I think the show did a really good job of keeping it under wraps.
Oh yeah,
which I think is important.
Even
you know?
I was shocked, and not much shocks me with this show anymore. So
yeah. So they did a really good job of not letting you know it was me.
Yeah.
And I did a good job of not letting you know it was me. And so the surprise worked. And I think that's important in a show like this to keep it fresh. I think, the response I've gotten is overwhelming and positive. But it's also very possible that people who are bummed aren't going to reach out and say, I'm bummed you're back. You know, so, you know.
I guess. You know,
I mean, maybe some would. But overall, it's been really positive. I think there's a guarded optimism because they want to know how this played out. Mm. You know, because the fans are savvy and smart and have done their homework and have watched the show. Mm. And that's where I think this episode is exciting because as we get more into the world and figure out more of what happened and how this all played out, that's, I think, going to excite and interest the fans because it's meat to chew on. You know, like, this is interesting. And that's where Meredith's rock-solid script comes into play and does a great job of laying the foundation and then making it beautifully detailed and nuanced and all the things you're talking about getting deep into the character. There's stuff I would read her script and email her and go, you pulled this reference from eons ago. Like, she did her homework, man. She knew the character really well before she started writing this episode so that it was really well fleshed out and built on solid ground. And I'm saying that as the guy who played it. It would have bummed me out had they built this house on sand. And I would have been like, oh man, okay, cool. We got it back, but I wish it was just cooler. But that's not the case. I thought it was executed beautifully on the page. Awesome. Which makes it even more fun to direct, because then you love every toy you got in your toy box, and now it's just playtime.
Yeah, because that was the biggest element. I'll let you go in one moment, but the biggest thing that interested
me... I got 45 minutes of practice. I got nowhere to go.
Oh, okay.
no rush here.
The biggest thing for me was that, your role has involved a fair amount of sort of turns around the corner, like where you've played an episode where presumably what you're playing was the truth to you, that the story reveals is a lie, you know, like even from going from the trickster to Gabriel and stuff like that. And so I'm curious about how that's going to play into this. What you're saying sounds like that we're really going deeper into the truth. And it was not something that felt like something that eradicated the truth of the work you'd been doing before.
I think that's very accurate. I think that's why Meredith did a great job, is she didn't go, "We're just kidding, here's what really happened," and obliterate 7 years of what do you call it, canon story of Gabriel. She built on that. She didn't erase it.
Yeah,
and I think that's key to this story being valued by the fandom and to stand up to their critical eye. Mm. That's what I think is interesting about it. And you know, of course, the audience will judge as they will at this point. I mean, it's out there, or it's about to be out there. You know, she did her level best to tell the story in an honest way, but it was unique and creative and fascinating. And then I did my best to perform it correctly and then direct it correctly.
Yeah.
And add layers at each step of the way, add layers, make it interesting, you know, find nuances, find beats. And so now we have this thing that she is very proud of and I'm very proud of, and we're just fascinated to see what the response will be. Because there's always going to be some negative. You know, somebody, I was talking to one of the directors who directed an episode. He's like, "Wow, a lot of people loved my episode, but there are a lot of people who tore it apart." And I said, "Welcome to the world of art." But that's like any, you know, you paint a canvas and hang it up in a museum, you probably don't want to stand there while people shuffle past it. That's what social media is. You have to be very careful about that, because you do your best, you put your best foot out there, you do the best work that you're proud of to tell the story you want to tell. And if you want to read what they say, please do. But know that part of the knowing it's a success is the debate that follows. You can't have people love it without some people hating it. That's part of the dialogue that goes on. I don't think that's totally negative, because I don't think everybody should have to love everything. It's cool to have it batted around and debated and discussed and nuances pointed out and details kind of argued over. All that's great. It's just if you're the artist, sometimes it's like getting, you know, poked in the ribs a little too hard. So you have to be careful about how close you want to stand to the fire. All that to say, I am interested to see how the fans react.
Yeah. It also sounds like just based on the synopsis that has been released for the rest of the season, you know, this arc, seems to continue. You know, Gabriel is sort of a major ensemble player to the close of the season. You know, we've got Rowena, Jack, you know, we've got all of these characters getting, really big group of characters going into the close of the season for Supernatural. All tying back to this cosmic story, this sort of fated story that, you know, is where we left Gabriel in season 5, this, you know, archangels, you know, Michael and Lucifer, you know, whichever version of them it is that we're talking about. So, does this ending of this Supernatural season feel like something new, bigger than ever to you or from your involvement, or is it like kind of a servicing of something we never covered before?
Well, I feel like, and again, I don't want to get too detailed into it because I don't want to, you know, accidentally spoil stuff, but I feel like one of the things that's really cool about the buildup as we ran towards the end of the year here is the scope. Yeah. They have a lot of players involved. Sometimes the endings are intensely awesome, but on the smaller, not smaller scale in terms of story, but smaller scale in terms of players.
Yes.
And this is a deep bench of old and new coming together in this sort of last leg of the sprint here. And I think that's fascinating. And I think story-wise, that is unique. We haven't seen, you know, this many players from this many years of the show kind of interacting and crossing paths and teaming up or butting heads, what have you, as part of the build up to the climax of the season. So I think it's really well crafted by Andrew and the team.
Yeah, I'm actually curious. I will let you go because I have to go as well. But I'm actually curious if any of that has translated off screen to your convention circuit in terms of a lot of people who are regulars on the circuit who maybe haven't been on the show in a while, you know, or were killed off and brought back, you know, Ruthie, you know, even Sam Smith for the past couple of years, yourself and maybe some others that we haven't seen yet, what it's like to everyone being like, oh my God, like this is, you know, does that translate at all to kind of the environment of the conventions that a lot of these regulars are now actually like regulars on screen as well as on the circuit?
Well, it's interesting. Socially, no, because socially we've all been friends for so long that we're used to dying off, getting back on, dying off, not getting back on, whatever. I mean, you know, hell, I'm a mainstay on the convention circuit.
Yeah, of course.
And I haven't been on the show in 7 years, you know, so there's a kind of a different strata between show fame and con fame. A lot of people who are successful in the con circuit are, you know, haven't been on the show for a while. Case in point, Matt Cohen and me have been like rock solid in that world forever. Rob Benedict had a big role in season 11, but it's still been a couple of years at this point.
Yeah.
And for Matt, it's been forever. And for me, it's been forever. So, but then you have Ruthie and Sam Smith, especially Sam Smith is a perfect example. And Pellegrino, people who were on it forever ago, went away and now have returned with great fanfare. It has changed, say, a little bit of the hierarchy in terms of, okay, Ruthie's a big player on, you know, in the show, so now she'll be in a different slot in terms of where we put her panel or Pellegrino. Like, we move everybody around like on the chessboard like that.
Okay.
But that's sort of the pragmatic business part. But that doesn't change. We're fortunate that we all get along. There's no egos. You bring in Jeff Parise, who plays Asmodeus, and he snaps in as easily as, you know, as the veterans, and you bring in Alex Calvert, he snaps in. I mean, everybody sort of has their place and fills their gap in this sort of entertainment universe that we've created as part of the Supernatural Roadshow, which is our convention circuit.
Yeah.
And so it, there's a lot of excitement, you know, there's excitement to see their favorites back.
Yeah, that's but kind of the, what I mean.
Yeah, the loyal fans are loyal fans. I mean, like, you know, there are Gabriel fans, there are Lucifer fans, there are Rowena fans, and nothing's going to change that regardless of how long you've been gone or how, you know, how fresh you are into the show. What I think is interesting, and we'll see how this plays out, is I was off the show so many years that to a lot of younger viewers, I will be a new character returning. You know, they saw my shows in reruns, but they didn't ever see it play out in real-time drama.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this next arc, the arc that started a couple episodes ago, is and reintroducing me to some and introducing me to others. And I think that makes is really fascinating. And that can only, you know, be achieved by a show that's been on this long.
Yeah, it really is one of a kind, I suppose.
Oh, for sure.
You mentioned, you know, Jeffrey Priest, who obviously you had that arc with Asmodeus. And I'm not sure, you know, if this is actually going to be addressed in the episode. So maybe it is, and it's a total no-go zone. It sounded very interesting that your return was that first shot of the, you know, the lips sewn shut, which is obviously an homage to Loki, like to the mythological Loki. And this may be a question that conventions and stuff have covered, but I haven't seen them all. Do you believe that Gabriel really was Loki? That, you know, like that he left heaven and then actually was that demigod, or do you think that it was like a legitimate cover-up?
I think that that is the question.
Ah, okay.
That, as far as I'm concerned, that is the question, and that is the debate. And I think there are some things that will make that question even more prominent going forward.
Okay.
I'll say no more than that, but I think that is the writers are no dummies, and I think that's a really interesting level they've added and is going to add to the debate about the character going forward.
Interesting. I might leave it there then in that case. I will get back in touch with Brittany or you know, with yourself.
Cool. All right. That is now recording. Let me grab my phone because Meredith was texting me some stuff. Anyway.
The date is May 13th.
Oh.
Sunday. The location, somewhere outside of Rome, Italy.
Yes.
The place, undetermined. Hallway near a hotel.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Natalie here with Richard Speight. We're here to follow up on our Supernatural interview regarding the very Richard Heavy episode written by Meredith Glynn, Unfinished Business. Now that we have seen the episode and can talk in more detail about the kind of enormity of that situation.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah, first of all, obviously, amazing, huge aspect, you know, amazing job. Everyone loved it, as far as I know, cast and fans. But yeah, it's just a massive endeavor to discover, you know, everything that we've discovered about the character, plus the technical aspects of not only, you know, directing yourself as an actor, but directing yourself as an actor as two separate characters
right.
that interact.
Yeah.
So what was the biggest reveal for you, the biggest shock about what you discovered, like, with the script? And then what was the biggest validation that was like, yes, like, that's what I wanted, that's what I felt?
The biggest reveal to me was the way Meredith dove deeply into the flawed nature of Gabriel. That she tackled the idea, which has already been played with in earlier seasons, but just very much on the surface, that Gabriel is a weak figure in many ways. Because the thing that I loved about this episode was, though he was on a, you know, vengeance quest against Loki, the more we learned, the more one would have to tilt their head and go, are we sure Loki did you wrong?
Mm.
Or did you do Loki wrong?
Mm.
Because Gabriel made a deal, albeit, you know, with the devil, so to speak. I mean, it's honor amongst thieves, but he made a deal with Loki, and then he broke the deal.
Yeah.
And his breaking of the deal caused someone very close to Loki to get killed.
Yeah.
So Loki responded by getting the guy tossed in a cellar.
Mm.
It's hard to feel bad for Gabriel in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel bad for him because we like him, because we know him on screen.
Mm.
But when you stop and think about it, Gabriel really kind of mangles this from the jump, in my opinion.
Mm.
Yes, he was mistreated. Yes, he was abused. But he put himself in the path of that bullet.
Yeah.
And he did so dishonorably out of the gate.
Mm.
He did it to dodge the responsibility of dealing with the apocalypse.
Mm.
He left the boys hanging. Yes, he stood up in front of Lucifer and tried to fight him, but now we find out that really that was a ruse. So that kind of diminishes a lot of the impact of what that was all those many years ago. So here's a character who is lovable for his charm and his wit, but not necessarily for his character.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. I've seen a lot of kind of quote-unquote discourse, you know, like Gabriel, you know, as a fan-favorite character, because he's, you know, fun and, like, all of that kind of stuff, is like, in the time that he has been absent, you know, has been a bit, like, softened in the eyes of the, you know, the fans
sure.
who, you know, like those qualities of him. But he is a, you know, cruel and ruthless and selfish
right.
character.
And the more
in the reality of,
right.
of his actions.
Absolutely. And I think the way
yeah.
Meredith tackled it from a story perspective was amazing, because she just started peeling away layers of the onion, you know? I mean, we're talking about revealing Gabriel's deeper, more flawed nature.
Mm.
This is a guy who goes after Loki, who only went after him after he, Gabriel, breached their contract.
Yeah, like he was, Loki did right by him,
yeah.
and then he broke the deal and then
yeah.
got the, yeah, the smack.
And so when
yeah.
I have this fight with Loki and Gabriel, I don't know who I'm pulling for.
Mm.
I kind of maybe am pulling for Loki.
Mm.
I like Loki. I think Loki's a cool character. I think Loki seems to be a man, maybe a quirky, you know, Norse god of questionable alliances, but at the end of the day, I feel like that's a guy who would keep his word. I feel like Loki, the way he comports himself, the way he's designed on the page, and I went with it cinematically, is someone who would stick to a deal. So when Gabriel breaches that deal and then goes after Loki's children.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's a big F you from Gabriel and Loki.
Yeah.
You don't mess with the man's kids. Yeah. And that's where I love the dialogue in that fight, because the fight became like, you think I deserve to die? You think my sons deserve to die? For your spinelessness? To me, that was super intense.
Yeah, totally.
And I went after that cinematically and performance-wise in the shooting of that fight scene, because to me that was the ultimate insult that Gabriel would think for some reason he had some moral high ground in his pursuit of vengeance. He's like, are you kidding me? You got my dad killed, and now you're mad that I retaliated? Really? You're mad that I retaliated? So now you're going to come at my children who had nothing to do with this? Like, that really puts Gabriel in a morally questionable stance.
Yeah.
In that fight.
Yeah. Speaking of their final interaction, the fight, you know, between Gabe and Loki. In the technicality of it, you know, I was watching it last night and sort of picking apart the scenes where it was, you know, coverage of just one of you.
Right.
Did you have what was the situation with the stunt double or doing that coverage back and forth between?
From a technical standpoint, I hired an actor. We hired an actor who could act, who was similar enough in my physicality to look like me once we put him in the costume and the wig and everything.
Yeah.
As an actor named Andrew, and he knew his lines, knew the lines every day from both characters, showed up every day.
Mm.
Didn't get used a ton, but he got used a ton on that day.
I mean,
he was the other guy.
Yeah.
And he and I, we had dressing rooms on stage, and as opposed to, you know, out in the parking lot in a dressing room, we just built little temporary dressing rooms right there, little curtains hanging up, and we would do a bit, run back, change, come back out, do the other bit, run back, change. It was madhouse. It was like theater, trying to, you know, make quick changes and come back and continue the scene.
Yeah, so you did it back and forth, not all of the coverage of you as Gabriel on one day and all of the coverage of you as Loki on.
Well, if you watch this, if you watch it, if we do it all one direction, the characters switch via direction. So, like, it'll be Gabriel.
Yeah, and shot then from the...
Yeah, Gabriel runs in the hallway, and we're all across Loki to Gabriel. But then, after he smashes him into the window, he turns, and now it's... That shot is now Loki.
Mm.
We did only a few special effects, and we shot that scene completely out of order.
Mm.
For example, the first shot I shot of that fight is Jared and Jensen arriving.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to not have to have those two gentlemen waiting all night while I did this fight scene.
Yeah, yeah.
So we started at the end and then jumped around a lot. So it was very, very, very... Usually you don't do a fight like that. Usually a fight scene... You started the beginning, you ended the end. We started at the end, we didn't shot the middle, then we shot the beginning, then we shot some more of the middle. So it was very compartmentalized. So I had to be very clear in my head with the performance beats what I wanted Loki to be doing and where I wanted him to be in each piece, so that when I did that little piece, it was going to fit in the grander scheme when I laid it all together chronologically.
Mm.
So I shot out Jared and Jensen early on, and then would do my best, you know, you have to kind of shoot via direction, but you end up, oh, we need to switch this way, that way. You do the best to plan it, but then when you look through the lens, you realize, oh, wait, we need to switch this now. And, you know, it's very much a prepare yourself like a crazy man, but then also be ready to adjust in the field.
Yeah. Given that you were acting and directing, you know, in it and directing the two characters, obviously the shoot is 8 days. Did you have like a longer prep than usual, or a longer shoot than usual?
I did not have a longer shoot than usual. The one thing I had in terms of prep that most directors don't get is I got earlier drafts of the script.
Did you get the writer's draft?
I did.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Because they wanted me, Andrew and Meredith and Bob Singer, Andrew Dabb, Meredith, wanted to be sure that I was up to speed with the story early on.
Mm.
So I was getting... I got the last outline, I think, and I got the writer's draft, so I could start to, because they understood the enormity of the task I was being handed, and they wanted to give me as much mental time, even if it wasn't, I mean, you can't prep without a set, you can't physically draw plans, but you can start thinking about scenes and beats, and for me, I can start memorizing lines and that kind of thing. Because that's what I did first. First thing I did was memorize all the lines.
Yeah.
Second thing I did was figure out how to direct the scenes, you know?
Yeah. Obviously, this also involved the reveal of the truth about Gabriel and Loki, and that question that's existed since, you know, 13 years ago.
Right.
Was that story anything close to what you'd imagined, or had you imagined something different in terms of, you know, Gabriel actually, you know, leaving heaven and then popping up in Norse mythology at, like, as the original Loki?
Here, I'll tell you what I had thought. No, just so you know, when I say what I had thought, I mean in passing.
You hadn't got a strict...
No, I hadn't obsessed about it, and I hadn't done the research around it, and I hadn't done... So it was very much Meredith did the right, brilliant, deeply rooted, well-researched, and very creative version of the story. But... Ciao. But my interpretation, guesswork, if I had just been sort of off the cuff discussing it with crew and friends, you need an answer?
I'm just taking time. It's totally fine.
With crew and friends, was I always thought that if Gabriel had fooled all these pagan gods, that he was Loki, I assumed, because I thought Gabriel was a man of iffy character, that he had captured Loki. But I thought Loki was in captivity.
The victim,
I thought Loki was in captivity, and that we would see Loki break out, and Loki track down Gabriel.
Interesting.
So I saw the story being exactly the reverse.
Pretty close, yeah.
Literally the inverse of whatever.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. That's really cool. Yes, obviously what we got was this, you know, long-awaited backstory, I suppose.
Yes, and I loved it. And I loved being able to... It gave the audience and me as the performer and the director to create who is Loki now. We could sort of create that character and figure out who he is.
Yeah. So what was that like for you to create that character of Loki?
You know, for whatever reason, it came to me very quickly what I wanted to do with it. I think a lot of it was how Meredith wrote the scenes and how she structured the character build. To me, if Gabriel is the irresponsible, you know, playboy of a son, Loki's the opposite. Loki is completely dialed in.
And that's so interesting, because that's not usually what Loki is in other interpretations of Norse mythology.
But here's my thought, though, is that Loki is a trickster god. Loki can use his clever wit and his ruses in the same way an archer would use an arrow. Mm. You don't constantly fire them. You pull them out when needed. Mm-hmm. So my thought was that Loki would be a very dialed in, well-comported, self-controlled person or god who knew exactly what he was doing, what he wanted to do, and how he wanted to do it. And then he would use his powers to get there, which were trickery and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So he has the ability to use that whenever he wants. He has the ability to be as rambunctious as he wants to be, and he can be.
But it's all manipulation.
It's a choice, you know, he likes to shut it off.
Uh-huh. It's loud.
Yeah,
I'll say it.
So no, that was my thought. So that when I didn't want to have two, you know, jocular characters doing battle.
Yeah, like, I'm wackier.
I was thinking that Loki, who was a Norse god, there's something something so cool and grounded and brash about that I wanted to. I gave him sort of an Al Capone feel, and I didn't play him Italian, but I'm saying that sort of, I'm very much in control, I'm very much what I'm doing, you know. The way I blocked that scene was he literally is getting ready to kick Dean's ass. He just walks slowly, takes his hat off, takes his jacket off, rolls up his sleeve,
like he knows he's gonna win.
Yes,
so there's
he's
no
very
rush.
And he knows he's gonna kick some ass. That's very methodical. Now, if he wanted to snap his fingers and be on the other side of Dean, he could have. And if he needed to, he would have. And he decided to pull a trick and be a hologram to distract him. But if he's trying to buy himself time so he can be up there messing with Gabriel, he's going to move slow. He's going to tell his story, all of which is heartfelt. And I feel like he feels a connection with Dean anyway, because Dean being sort of the more, the team leader of the Winchester boys, mm-hmm. I feel like he thought, you get it, you're a leader, you understand, mm-hmm. you know.
You have honor.
Yeah. Honor amongst thieves.
Yeah, that's really sort of a wider question about, you know, your current experience with the show, you know, directing this season and last year. You know, what you've that ties into kind of what we see in this script of Meredith's. Not to discount any of the past of the show, but do you feel like this work you've been doing under Andrew Dabb's team has been like a new depth for the show? Like that there's been that these character moments, not just for your character, but that what you've been working on for the boys and stuff is a new direction for the show.
Well, here's the thing. I would go back and say that, you know, for me as a director, doing Just My Imagination, that's a beautiful, beautiful examination of Sam's youth mm-hmm. and Dean's youth. And that's under Jeremy Carver.
Yes.
So I don't feel like something was missing, and now Dab is fixing what you know.
No, that's not what I mean at all. There's just been like a few threads picked up, and these new writers of it seems kind of like these new writers that this team that he's put together with Meredith and Davey have gone, and they've looked at threads from the past
100%.
And really brought these threads back, like very intensely.
100%. It's so cool.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, you kind of feel like you're the upperclassman.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like freshmen, like in their experience. They're not freshmen. Very experienced writers. But they're coming into this world, and we've been around here for a while.
Yeah.
And they come in, and they've done their homework, and they're fired up, and they're excited, and they like the show, and they like the characters, and they like exploring it. I mean, everybody, Bob Behrens, Shigaki, you know, the whole team, everybody, and Andrew, of course, himself, writing the stories, seems to have a real passion for the stories they're telling.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I said about this script with Meredith, and I've worked with Davey as a writer.
Yeah.
There's a lot of passion on that page.
Yeah.
I could tell she did her homework.
Yeah.
I could tell she gives a crap about this story. And that means a lot to me when I'm the guy who played that character.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to come back and jump the shark. I don't want to just get a paycheck and be on the show and ruin everything we've built over the last, you know, 13 seasons. It would be pointless. It would be silly.
Yeah.
But we did the opposite. She took this opportunity to bring, you know, Eugenie and Brad brought Gabriel back.
Yeah.
And then the other writers took the opportunity to continue his journey, I'm using Gabriel specifically as an example. And I thought it did so beautifully.
Yeah.
And interestingly and deeply.
That's it's a very, like, this is a very cut and dried example of that happening, like, with Gabriel, with this exploration. Yeah, but it feels like this era has had so many threads pulled on. And even with the lead characters, with Sam, which comes into your episode here a bit as well, and his growing trauma, like his growing issues with revenge and trauma mm-hmm. with Lucifer. You guys have that conversation. There's a couple of scenes here, I think, that didn't make it in, that he's even more blunt about, like, you know, his feelings about Lucifer or the trauma, you know, that he reacts. So, with that scene with you and Sam, again, like one of Yoki's episodes, not one you were involved with, had him talking to Ruthie about this long repressed trauma, and it just feels like all these threads have been coming up again with these writers, that they've found stuff that was never continued, and that they've worked it back in. Gabriel and Sam have this sort of current connection, you know, that conversation about revenge mm-hmm. at the end of this episode, about, you know, whether it helps and stuff, and it, you know, it feels like Sam is sort of gearing up for that.
Right.
And then at the end, Gabe is maybe, you know...
Well, it's a lie. If you watch that showdown, that's the thing about Gabriel. It's like, you so want him to step up every now and then. And be honest. And he can say, you know what? No, I don't feel that great. You watch the showdown, the final showdown with Gabriel and Loki, and it's clear that Gabriel... that once again, Gabriel wins by cheating. Mm. He brings in two dudes to throw him a sword. Mm. I mean, cheating, whatever. You know, Loki uses a hologram to distract Dean, so, yeah. I mean, you call it what you want. But when they stand down and Gabriel, and Loki says to Gabriel, you're a failure, you're a joke.
Yeah.
You live for pleasure, you stand for nothing, and at the end of the cycle, you die for. The reason why that stings is, at that moment, if Gabriel were to die, Loki would be right. Mm-hmm. So where's the vengeance in killing the truth? Mm-hmm. Where's the satisfaction, I mean, in the vengeance of killing the truth? There was something about Gabriel in that moment that I think he knew as he was taking Loki out. There was that Loki just had that presented to him. Everything Loki said while he was beaten in town was true.
Yeah.
And then Gabriel had to soak that in. And then when Sam comes to him and says, hey, man, do you feel better? Gabriel has the opportunity to go, you know, I don't know, man. It's a slippery slope, but it's hard to say. But he, obviously, he's lying to himself as well. Mm. He's trying to convince himself that all that effort was worth it. But he doesn't offer a lifeline to Sam, which is...
And then the sort of the further question for that is, do you think, when Sam kind of was like, yeah, that's what I thought, do you think he believed Gabriel, or do you think he was like, oh, yeah, you're lying?
No, I think he believed Gabriel.
Like, he's validated something in Sam that wasn't true.
And again, I don't think Gabriel's doing it out of any malice for Sam. Gabriel genuinely likes Sam. But I think Gabriel's trying to convince himself that he didn't just make a giant mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
That maybe he should have gone to Loki and apologized versus killing.
Yeah.
But he didn't. And now he's not getting any emotional release from that experience.
Yeah.
And here's
and he
Sam.
He doesn't want to let Sam.
But, right, yeah. He dragged the boys into this. He almost, you know, they get shot at, they get almost stabbed, so he didn't want to get them. He didn't want to tell them that it was all a waste.
I will just jump to a couple of other things. Firstly, there was one scene that the flashback scenes to the party lifestyle,
right?
Originally meant to be black and white in the script. Did you choose to what happened there? Did you choose to change that?
Or? I think a lot of I chose to ditch that, but I think a lot of times when a writer puts that in, what they're saying in so many words is
it
should
feel
differ
different.
Cinematically from the normal footage.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
You know, so it's just a note.
Yeah.
For this should feel different.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I did it a different way.
Yeah, and then you and Meredith, I know it was in her script, and your casting, you know, chose to have that kind of equal opportunity sexy with the porn stars, mm-hmm. male and female. Is that that entire environment, creating that environment with the Loki's children and the party and stuff like that, what was that like?
Oh, super fun and super easy.
Yeah.
I mean, on the page, and I think we talked about this a little bit in the early interview, but, you know, when you say, hey, actresses and actors, come audition for porn stars, not a lot of people want to do that.
Yeah.
But we convinced some really talented people that what we were doing was funny, and honestly, the title should have been Party Girl, Party Boy.
Yeah.
It was not about overt sexuality. No.
Yeah.
Even when Gabriel retells his stories, or when you see Gabriel in the Casa Erotica stuff, it's always fun. It's always tongue-in-cheek. He never has a debasing energy about sexuality or his role in it or the role of the people with whom he's appearing. And I wanted to go up a level. Mm. This isn't a porno movie. This is literally a party in a kick-ass
everyone
flat.
Everyone wants to be here.
Right. It's like, I consider it like the Vegas suite party.
Yeah.
So, I was like, I wanted that vibe. So I wanted a guy there. And if I'd had more money, I'd have had more guys and more gals. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it fun. And I had people making out in the shower. And I wanted it to kind of feel like a loose, fun party without it feeling overly gross and debaucherous.
Yeah, the thing that kind of sold that for me as well was it wasn't just the, you know, the gods hiring these people. They were all having fun with each other.
Absolutely.
And stuff.
Well, that was absolutely the bit. The bit was supposed to be, this is a party, this is the thing. It's, Richard the director and wants the actresses and actors doing it to feel comfortable because it could be awkward. And Richard the visionary, helmer of the episode in terms of being a director and actor, wants it to feel probably funner than it was. It's a retelling.
Yeah.
It's not a documentary.
Yeah.
You know, so whenever you retell anything, the boys are a little buffer, the girls a little hotter, and the party is a little more fun than it probably was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
completely changing track. You had these abrupt but very very smooth but very abrupt transitions into the apocalypse world as well with Mary and Jack and Kevin. So what was that aspect of the shoot like? And, you know, because you did that as well in Seven, that world.
Right.
And, but you also you obviously dealt with that very traumatic scene between Kevin, you know, who obviously Osric is a friend. And
yeah, man, that was cool. Listen, man, I loved that scene. And I read that scene. And to me, there were so many political allegories going on there. Yeah. It was with, you know, with all the young men with dreams of some sort of redemption in an afterlife who strapped bombs in her chest and walked into a shopping mall.
Yeah.
To me, that's what this was. This was Kevin became a bomber, which is just awful. And the idea that Kevin Tran, a character we've come to know and love, would be so broken that he would think somehow there's redemption at the end of this rainbow, which is what must go through the minds of the young men who are lured into this false sense of being a hero when they kill innocent people.
Yeah, it was interesting because this show obviously has so many controversies with, you know, death of beloved characters and stuff like that. Whereas this one, you know, for all that it was awful, it didn't feel like, oh my god, screw you, Supernatural, for killing someone we love. Like, it felt right.
Yeah, and Kevin doing it?
Yeah, well, like, not just him doing it, but, like, you know, obviously we love Kevin. He's already been traumatically killed once, and, you know, here he is being traumatically killed again. But it still felt like a really right sort of story.
Well, two things go into that to me. One, Brad Mutini brought Kevin back in 1307.
The other one you did.
And Meredith continued that story. And Kevin is alt Kevin. He's the wrong Kevin.
I
mean, he's the right Kevin, but he's a different Kevin. And he's more broken and more off balance and more quirky. It's like the whole chemistry of who he is like changed and maybe a little bit for the negative. And he seems more lost and more confused and at the end more broken. And I think at that point, it's kind of like you almost want him to take himself out of his own misery in a way. Not that you want him to go away, but you're like, if you can't fix what's broken, don't stay miserable. Don't stay this damaged because we love you too much to see you in this position. And that's one. And number two, Osric performed the crap out of it. Like, Osric. But I knew he would. I was not worried about that at all. Osric is a very talented guy, very open performer who's willing to go there. And he went there. And he did exactly what he needed to do to land that empathetic beat with the fans so they understood what he falsely believed that this was important to do.
Cool. In closing, your last scene, the brother moment, when they're talking about, you know, what had happened, seems to kind of set up the arc for what we'll see in the finale. Obviously, I'm not going to ask you to spoil that, but, you know, Sam's kind of rallying to Dean, you know, about benching him and that we'll be together. Dean kind of ends on that moment of, like, oh, fuck. Like, yes, it's lovely that he thinks that, but there's no way I'm going to let him do that. So what am I going to do to prevent that? So, you know, obviously you've been in these following episodes as the actor, you know, when they're on this journey. So what was this last scene to you? Like, how much did you know about what was coming next? And what were you putting into that scene between the boys?
Okay, I knew nothing about what's coming next.
Okay.
But you don't need to know what's coming next to grasp the roots of that conversation.
Yeah.
Because that conversation is built on the past and on the future.
Yeah.
And there's so much that Dean is talking about that is referential to the earlier episode, the year
through.
I mean, back when Gabriel was on the show.
Yeah.
And it was just an interesting exploration of Jared, of Sam, trying to remind kind of the only father he's ever known, his older brother Dean, that they are equals. They are not
father and son.
Yeah. And there's nothing I love more than watching those boys act those things out. Yeah. They throw in all these levels, and I had an idea. I knew what I wanted to do. I was specific about the glass Dean had. I was specific about the bottle he was pouring from. I wanted him at the head of the table. I built this whole thing to feel like that. Mm-hmm. Sun coming in from the living room, Dad already lounging, having the fine crystal, having a drink at the end of the day. It felt very much like I built it to be, to visually tell that story as well.
Yeah.
And to spin around, and Dad's in the armchair, and Son is sitting there.
I'm a real boy, Dad.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah.
But then Dean is forced to acknowledge, as Sam walks away, that yes, there's a little bit of I'm not going to let that happen, but also, son of a bitch, he's right.
Yeah.
He's not wrong. And at some point, Dean knows he's got to get over this as much as Sam does.
He kind of smiles. And I think some people interpreted that as like, oh, isn't that, you know, yeah, I love him, it's nice. But to me, it was kind of like an oh, fuck. Like the and I don't know.
It was both. And that's what that's I, and by the way, just, you know, Jensen and I talked about that. Like, what is this last beat? We had a conversation about that because this is what gets me up in the morning. The details like that.
In
a performer. I love performance. I love watching great performers perform and then working with them to explore other avenues. And when you talk about that smile, is it pride to watch Sam stand up for himself and go, you're never doing this toe-to-toe, my man? And that, is there something Dean's going, wow, okay. And then also, is there sadness?
Yeah.
Is it pride? Is it sadness? Is it a mix of both? Is it a, I can't let him do that, or how do I deal with this? There's so much that works into that beat. And by the way, I could have run that. I cut it. Like, it was black. I could have run 15 more seconds, and you'd have seen, you know, 7 more decisions.
Face acting.
It's just legitimate acting. It's just Jensen going through, it's Dean going through the struggle of
his hang-up.
He's a man. He's got issues with the way I treat him. Is it him or is it me?
Yeah, that's awesome.
It might be me.
That's awesome. We should probably leave it there. So I could talk much more, but that's just, awesome.
Another time, another conversation.
I want to talk to you about Rob Hader and, like, his characterization in the fight scenes and stuff. Like, the way that he does the choreography for fights that's, like, so character-based and stuff.
Rob is great. Rob is an actor's fight choreographer.
Yeah, it's amazing.
He cares about performance, not just the ballet.
He's my number one interview for the show. They won't give it to me because they don't let the crew do interviews, but I want to interview him so badly. And I really want to meet him and talk to him about, like, I've talked to him on Twitter a few times about, like, the character work. Like, Dean, this season especially, he's, like, Jared mentioned in his panel as well in a way that was very validating, not about the fights, but, like, I see Sam as a strategist and Dean as a tactician. Like, Sam is a big picture planner and Dean is in the moment, like, on the fly, and there's so much of that in his fighting at the moment. Like, even just, like, he'll, like, grab an object and use it, and that is so in character in a way that has maybe not always been there. Like, you know, sometimes it's just punch, 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 and Rob has, like, added these things.
No, Rob is great. And Rob, if you watch the way we stay the fights and the sword fight and the fight with Loki and Gabriel, he and I talk about character first, fight second. He's very much into the acting.
Yeah, I love it.
He's an actor.
I want to meet him at some point.
He's an actor, and his second in command, Kirk, is an actor, so they understand acting, and it's great.
Yeah.
So when we're rehearsing the fight, they're
like,
in character.
Yeah, like, what would this character's mind do, not just how can I punch? Yeah.
100%.
And I've seen so much of it in the last season.
Now, Rob's
like a visible change to what was perfectly fine fighting before, but it's like next.
No, it's a valuable addition to the roster.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For doing this with me. I think it's really awesome, I'm very, very stoked.
When we started this conversation, I was at a baseball field in Los Angeles, California, watching my son practice baseball. Yeah. And we finished this conversation in Rome, Italy, in the back halls.
It's a transcontinental dissection.
An Australian and an American, bringing it all together.
Yeah, it's awesome. Thank you so much. I'm